Okay. So, can you talk about what life was like for women in Japan, for the women who chose to become picture brides? What was their life situation like?
Well, majority of the women that I had interviewed who came as picture brides was, see, many, because of my clothing research, I got in contact unknowingly. I started interviewing these women who came as picture brides, and majority of them had came from a farm, farming area, agricultural, background. And so I think the reason many of them came, of course, was the bachelors were here, with as a contract laborers, and many times when they wrote home that when they're ready, they feel that they're ready to settle down, and they would write their relatives or friends to find them something, someone who's who would make a good wife, a hardworking woman who would work alongside their, the husband. And so that's how I think the matchmaking thing started. But majority of the women I interviewed came from farming villages, but there were some who came from, especially this one woman, Mrs. Saito. She was unusual. She had graduated high school. She was the valedictorian of her class, and she was already preparing to go to medical school. Her uncle graduated from Kyushu Medical School, and he was practicing in Osaka, Japan. And so she was going to follow her uncle's footsteps. So everything was arranged when this man from Hawaii went to Fukushima. And actually, he was through a picture bride exchange. He was supposed to marry another woman, but when he saw that woman, he was turned off because she was. He said she's too skinny, and too frail looking to work in the pineapple fields, and that's the reason why he turned her down. And this Mrs. Saito's mother heard about the story, and she thought rather than have her daughter go to medical school and face an uncertain future, for women in those days, this is she. Came that was about 1914, and so she felt that this man who was a successful entrepreneur, he invested in pineapple, land, and he became very wealthy and returned to Japan. So her mother, without telling her daughter, her mother had arranged everything through the matchmaker for her to marry this man. And so hers was an unusual situation. She was a sort of a picture bride situation, and she considers herself a picture bride too, but she came in a very, unusual way. And so when she got married, her mother had sent her to an aunt who had a baby at that time. So during that time, she had planned everything. The party and everything was all set when she returned from her aunt's home. So it was kind of forced on her. And so she didn't even take her wedding picture. She was so upset. She had a beautiful montsuki, that formal bride in kimono, but she told me she didn't even take a wedding picture. And so, but then her story about coming to Hawaii on the ship, because her husband was wealthy, they had a stateroom, coming to Hawaii, and but then they didn't know how to use knife and fork, so instead of going in the dining room to have their meals, they ate in the stateroom, because that was the funny part. And she was the only bride who really had the traditional montsuki, the Japanese bridal kimono, when she disembarked here in the port of Honolulu, because the other brides envied her because they had those homemade, hand-woven kimonos that they wore for the trip. So other than that, there was another unusual one that I gave at the talk story. Mrs. Tokis was unusual. Her husband-to-be was already on Kauai. He was born in Japan, but his mother died, and then the father came to Kauai to work on at a Lihue plantation. And of course, the Kamezo loved he always admired Hawaiian women. They were so beautiful. And so he kind of had crushes on, Hawaiian women. And in those days, intermarriage was, really unheard of. And so Kamezo's father decided that, oh, he wrote to his uncle in Japan to send a bride for his son because he was afraid that he was going to marry a Hawaiian girl. And so before then, this Kamezo was kind of good looking. Of course, he was kind of on the lazy side. He said, he wasn't a typical serious young man, He was a very happy-go-lucky person. And this one of the Hawaiian girlfriend's father told him one day that, oh, if you climb the highest coconut tree and see as far as you can, I'll give you that all that land that you can see, as far as you can see, and if you marry my daughter. And at that time, he didn't take it seriously. So after that, I think his father really started considering, that he should arrange a marriage for the a son. And so that's how Takatoki and Kamezo, the photos, when he wrote the uncle got the that woman's picture. The exchange started exchanging photos and letters. And so when I had interviewed them, he was 92 and Mrs. Toki was 88. And I asked her for her reaction when your photos when Kamezo's picture arrived at your home in Japan. I said, how did you feel? And she said, well, I was only she was 16 years old at that time, and she said she was too shy and embarrassed to look at the photo. The family made such a big fuss, and so she retreated to the bedroom and pretended to sleep. And then that night, somebody left that the future bridegroom's photo right next to a pillow. So when nobody was around, she took a good look at it and she thought, my, he's so handsome and not bald-headed like he is now. And so she was satisfied. And then on the other hand, I asked Kamezo, the future bridegroom, the bridegroom, I said, how did you feel when you received her picture? And said, well, she's average, she said, but she thought, I guess my father wanted me to get married. He had a stepmother by then. So my parents want me to get married. So he just accepted it, And then, of course, when she arrived in Hawaii, after all that exchange of photos and a letter writing through the go-between, when she arrived in Hawaii that morning, his father said, oh, Kamezo, you go pick up your bride. And that's in Lihue, Kauai. So he took the kinau, which took 5 hours for him to come to Honolulu. And no planes in those days. And so his wife was already here. And all the brides were behind the curtain. They were hidden behind the curtain. They had to take a quick physical exam. And what do you call that? Competence test, to test the literacy. And so after the exams were done, they were waiting their turn for the bridegrooms to claim them. And then, of course, Mr. Toki's story is funny because he was all dressed up, with a suit that somebody had given him and a brand new shirt and a tie that he had bought from the Chinese store on King Street. So he felt best, well dressed. But the only thing is he didn't have shoes, so somebody gave him an old pair of shoes which were so oversized. So walking to the pier, he said, oh, it made such a big sound, And so he said he was so embarrassed. And then while waiting at the pier, all the other grooms were waiting for their brides. And he said it was funny because they were all worried, filled with anxiety. They didn't know what kind of woman they're going to have. And so Kamezo thought, oh, what shall I do? She's real ugly, But she said, too late to change his mind. So, he has to just make the best of it. And so finally, one lady came out early and whispered into Kamezo's ear that if you want to find your wife, look for the biggest tabi in the underneath the curtain. And so he did. When he looked, he could tell that really 1 foot, pair of feet was extra large, you know, the tabi. And so when he lifted the curtain, sure enough, there was his wife. She had extra big feet. And so that was the introduction, you know, to his wife.
You mentioned an unusual story about a woman who was going to go to medical school and whose mother made her go to be a picture bride.
Okay.
Can you talk about a typical story? Like, what's a typical story about why a woman became a picture bride? Like, did women have other options besides becoming a picture bride? Like, they could have gotten married in Japan. So uh-huh. Why would they end up getting married to someone so far away?
I think many, like Mrs. Tazawa.
Wait, when you cover your mouth, you have to.
Okay. Yeah. Like Mrs. Tazawa told me, I think hers is typical too, because she was in Fukushima, and she said, actually, the reason she came to Hawaii was because she didn't want to. There were a lot of offers of marriage, you know. Somebody tried to, you know, get her married off to people there, but she didn't want to be a farmer's wife. She didn't want to work in the paddy fields, you know, get all dirty and, you know, in that muddy, you know, field. And so when this story of someone, you know, in Hawaii looking for a bride, she really took upon it immediately because she was adventurous and she didn't even worry, you know, what kind of a person he was. Just so she could find an excuse not to marry someone in the village because she didn't want to end up her life doing farming. So many people and some women also told me that they didn't want to, you know, be bothered with domineering mothers-in-law. So that was another reason. And majority, the reason I think these people came as picture brides, someone here who were related, unless you had some relatives or some men from the village who were already here looking for a bride. And there has to be some kind of connection because like Mrs. Kikugawa, the lady with the picture hat, hers was unusual. There's all different circumstances that they got involved in being a picture bride. She had no intention of being a picture bride, but her husband-to-be at that time was supposed to marry another woman from the neighborhood. And she had already was committed. She had already sent her picture in a formal kimono to her husband-to-be in Hawaii. But day before she was supposed to leave for Yokohama, she eloped with a boyfriend. She already had a boyfriend. And of course, the man here didn't know about that. And so 6 months later, that man divorced her. And she came back to the village. And that's when this Mrs. Kikugawa heard the aunt and this man's father discussing about that woman, that she wanted to come back, come to Hawaii to marry that man that she was supposed to be married in the first place. But this Ayako is her name, you know, the wife who actually got married to Mr. Kikugawa. When she overheard that, she was so upset and angry with that woman. She thought, oh, you know, she's no good because she eloped with her boyfriend, and then now when it didn't work out, she wanted to come to Hawaii as his wife. So she volunteered to come to Hawaii and bring that husband, Mr. Kikugawa, back to Kumamoto with her. But then the tables turned, you know. The parents thought her aunt and her father were cousins. So they decided that, oh, since Ayako is willing to go to Hawaii, they arranged it that she would end up marrying him. And she didn't know that. So when she came here, her husband was already waiting there and he had her picture. So he knew what she looked like. And so when he met her at the immigration station, he said, oh, you're Ayako, because he identified through the photo. And then so after he picked her up and, you know, he hired a haku, that's the heck, the horse and buggy, they call it haku, you know, and then took her to Haleiwa, where he worked for that Yoshida store. And of course, he had come as a contract laborer, but he was working for that Yoshida. He stayed there, I think, boarded there. And so She was surprised that they had already a wedding reception ready for them. So she didn't know. That was quite unexpected. And the clothing that is shown in my book, she has the picture hat and, you know, the cummerbund with the Gibson girl look, you know. And she had borrowed from the Mrs. Yoshida, who was the picture bride herself. She had worn it for her wedding. So she had loaned Ayako because she wasn't prepared to get married. Although she had her ceremonial kimono, you know, usually a woman brings one set of that, you know, the monsuki, the bridal kimono. But anyway, she has formal picture taken with that too. But hers was a very unusual story that because she volunteered to come and she didn't even know that she was going to be the bride herself, her father and the aunt had decided that, oh, you know, they might as well let them get married. And so, yeah.
Did women have the ability to decide for themselves who they married? Or it sounds, because like in this case,
she volunteered, yeah. But she didn't know.
Her parent or her family arranged for her to be married. So,
yeah.
Was that very, and then, did women have the choice to get married, or was it often the family's decision?
Sometimes, like Mrs. Toki's one, I spoke a while ago about the big feet. Okay. With her, I think she didn't mind getting married. She didn't care who it was, but because her sister came as a picture bride before her, and then she was married to someone on Kauai, and her sister sent her glowing reports about, oh, how wonderful life is in Hawaii, and she sent back money and gifts all the time to her family. And so she thought, oh, it doesn't matter who she got married to, because she thought life in Hawaii was paradise. And so with her, I think she didn't mind. I think some women really, without being forced, they didn't mind coming. Because like Mrs. Tozawa also, she wanted to get away from that, you know, farming village. And so she didn't care who she got married to, but I think majority of them, like Mrs. Sato, the picture bride from Okinawa, she was only 16. And she said she did have someone, a puppy love, you know. She told me about it. It was so nice, you know. Here she was already about 80-something. And she told me about her first, you know, the puppy love that she had back there. And how her boyfriend, you know, died in World War II. And she still kept up. The boyfriend, you know, married after he came back from war, yeah, and he died after that. But she said, actually, she didn't want to come, but her family was so poor, and they had to get her to get married to come to Hawaii to better her life, and they thought the husband-to-be would help support her family. That's the way it was. They sent money home. And Mrs. Ogawa is another good example. I showed you her picture. She got married in 1912, and her husband was already working out in Apupukea, an independent pineapple grower. Her brother-in-law was an independent pineapple grower, so her husband was already working under his brother-in-law. And so it's funny how she came as a picture bride because she was thrown into a group of picture brides. And then 1912, it was a quick marriage with the exchange of sake cups. You know that san-san kudo, 3 sips, altogether 9. They call it san-san kudo because you sip 3 times each and total of 9 sips, you know. And then that makes it, you're legally married in Japan when you go through their ritual. And then the wife's name is put into the family register in the village office. And you're declared legally married, accepted into the family. And from your own family, your name is crossed out because she's dying, you know. She's already dead. When you're married to another family, I have example of my mother's family register. When she got married, her name is crossed off. That's the way it is. You're declared dead. And so she enters the new family, and so they have to wait 6 months before they come here. So Mrs. Ogawa was strange. Her son was a marriage of convenience. She was the oldest of 10 children, and she learned to weave from a very young age. They were so poor. And when her husband-to-be, his father was very ill, and his mother was a frail woman, very tiny, couldn't take care of her husband. So they rushed and, you know, arranged this marriage. You know, Mrs. Ogawa, Tatsuno is her name. So they rushed her just to have her look after the father-in-law before the son left for Hawaii to work for this pineapple, independent pineapple growers in Pupukea. And so she took care of her father-in-law until he died. Yeah, that was really a marriage of convenience, but it turned out well because I think it was the way the families, without asking the children's permission, many times I noticed the marriage were arranged. And yet, on the other hand, there were some like Mrs. Tazawa and, you know, the other people who more or less knew what to expect, you know, and with adventure spirit, I think they consented.
Can you describe what people's, what did people in Japan think Hawaii was like?
You mean during that early 1900s?
Yeah.
Well, to them, you know, they heard from the early contract laborers who went back to Japan. They talked about all those, you know, Hawaii's really paradise, you know, and the streets paved with gold, although it wasn't. They gave such an elaborate, you know, story because they didn't want to consider themselves failures, right? Many of them didn't make the money, you know, as they thought they would. And so they gave glowing reports, and that's the reason why many people thought it was, you know, exciting to come to a foreign country. And so at the time, either it was Hokkaido was opening too, you know, and even my parents, they were deciding whether to go to Hokkaido or come to Hawaii. But they had, you know, more glowing, exciting reports about Hawaii that you can be rich, you know, within a certain time period if you worked hard enough. So I think that's what drew people. Of course, the climate too was very pleasant in Hawaii. So I think that was one, but the most important thing that drew people to Hawaii, especially the women, were people who were here kept on Mrs. Ogawa too, as poor as she was. They could barely make a living when she settled in Pupukea. Her husband was making only for 10 hours of work, 75 cents for the 10 hours a day, you know, and she made 65 cents a day working in the fields too. And so she showed me her hands, you know, twisted and, you know, full of, you know, all the her hands were all, you know, bruised and everything. The scars were still there. And it showed, you know, how hard she worked. And the money, as poor as they were, they sent half the money back home. And that's the reason why they couldn't go back home within the 3 years as they promised their parents. And yet, when they sent the money back to home, people back in the village thought they were rich. Because back in that village, they never saw such big money. You know, they were sending huge sum. Even if it was $20, it was big money, you know. And so I think that's what people had the vision that you come to Hawaii, you can strike it rich. It was a false kind of, you know, hope, yeah.
And you were talking about the family registry, mm-hmm. and can you talk about my great aunt's story, the Ogata story, about her, do you know it, Alma?
Yeah, Alma Ogata, yeah, right.
So she was in love with somebody, but her auntie said, if you don't do the picture bride thing, we're going to take you out of the family registry.
Oh, well, that could be it, because many times it happened if they didn't listen, you know. So I don't know about Alma's story, but...
Well, can you describe the significance of the family registry and why it would be so dreadful to be taken out?
Sure, because it's a disgrace unless you're married, unless the person died, your name wouldn't be erased, eliminated from the family register. It's such a dishonor if the person, doesn't listen to the parents, and your name is just wiped out from the family register. You lose your identity as a family. And in Japan, that's a really disgraceful thing. You don't have a family, no name, no one to belong to. So nothing could be worse. And even in Hawaii, I think we had a lot of that discrimination. If you married Okinawan person, in those days, even Naichi people from mainland Japan, if you married Okinawan people, there was so much discrimination during the early period. And so the person's name wasn't entered in the family register.
And now, just a little bit of history. Mm-hmm. Why did the picture bride process start?
It started because this is an age-old tradition in Japan, even during the Edo period and on. When people lived miles and miles away those days, you know how they traveled by foot? And the bride is living, so many, in village, hundreds of miles away, and there was no way, to do matchmaking, it was very, very difficult. And so they said they started exchanging photos, I don't know, during the end of the Edo period, probably they did have cameras, and they did start exchanging. But this matchmaking thing actually started from that procedure of matchmaking from that Edo period. And then, of course, the class, they try to equally, match the background. If you came from a high social status or middle class, it was a fine way of finding somebody equal to your standing. And that's, they felt that the marriage would go well, And then, so in Hawaii, when the contract laborers first came, many were married, they left families back home. And so they were the ones during the restrictive immigration period when they could summon for the family who were left behind, the wife and children. During that time, they could bring them in. And then also those men who came as bachelors and wanted to start a family here, they felt that they won't be able to make enough money to go back home. So as soon as they had enough remittance money, which was, it varies. I asked people, some said 300, some said 400. That's for the transportation and for the bride to prepare the dowry. So until the men saved that much, they couldn't send for their wives. And so that is how through locally, like even this Okinawan family, Mr. Funakoshi, a well-educated man, very scholarly, he told me their marriage was arranged through a friend while working in the cane field digging. And then they said, oh, how about, your daughter and my son get married? And that's how, they have somebody back in the village and, they want to bring them over. That casually marriages were arranged, through the uncle. And then sometimes that's how traditionally it started, that exchange of photos, and they came here. And of course, when the many times, because it was arranged to an intermediary, when the wife came, there's some really sad stories that this woman talked about. She waited for 2 weeks at the immigration station, and her groom-to-be didn't come to claim her. So every day she cried because she had only one-way passage. She didn't have any money to go back to Japan. And so Dr. Katsunuma, who played an important role, he's probably father of the, immigration period, because every picture bride I interviewed talk about Katsunuma-san. He was actually a veterinarian. He studied in Utah, became a veterinarian. And over here, Dr. Katsunuma was assistant to the inspector. He spoke Japanese and English both. So he became one of the inspectors and took charge of all the immigrants who came from Japan. So every picture bride mentioned Dr. Katsunuma. And so he felt sorry for this bride. Nobody came to claim her, so he took her home and gave her room and board, and eventually found her a good man, you know. And so one day she even appeared on the radio program. I was listening, I was doing dressmaking, and listened to her story. She said, oh, her husband just died a few years back, and they were talking about immigration and picture bride. She said, she came as a picture bride, and because her husband-to-be didn't come to claim her, Dr. Katsunuma was so kind to take her into his home and find her a good husband. And she could never have found such a wonderful husband. She's so grateful to Dr. Katsunuma. She said, even if she went around the country looking with musubi, you know, there's an old saying, Japanese saying, that when you travel around the country with musubi to, you know, sustain your hunger, you know, she said, even if she went around the country with musubi, you know, she could never find a good husband like the one Dr. Katsunuma found for her.
Do we know why her husband never showed up?
Oh, because he took a...
Start and say the reason why.
Oh, okay. Well, some of the stories that I found out was, of course, this man, he wanted to know, you know, what his future bride looked like. So unseen, he had, you know, watched her. And so one look at her, he changed his mind and he didn't go to claim her. You know, he just took off without claiming her. So actually he did go to the pier, you know, to see what she looked like. But then, so there are a lot of stories. Like another one, Mrs. Toki told me, the one, the lady with the big feet, you know, the bride with the big feet. That day, after her husband hired a horse and buggy and took her to that Kyushu-ya hotel, that night on the way, you know, she passed the hallway on the way to the restroom, and she saw this bride. She was on the same ship as she was, and she was just sobbing, you know, crying her heart out. And there was a man, you know, there, and she was old enough to be her father. And she found out that the proprietor of the hotel told her that that man had sent a picture of him when he was in his 20s, but he was almost double the age, you know, old enough to be her father. And so she was crying her heart out because she didn't know what to do. And so next day, she just disappeared. She just took off. So there are cases like that. They have no choice. They do follow the man home. And there's another woman that she came from Hiroshima as a picture bride. She wanted to escape because her mother, her parents, she came from a high status, you know. The father, uncle was an instructor in fencing, you know. They came from a very fine background, samurai family. And so her family wanted her to marry a naval officer, a relative, but she just didn't like that man, even if he was a high-ranking, you know, naval officer. She couldn't stand him. So she told a friend to find her somebody in Hawaii. And so that's the reason why, behind her parents' back, she arranged herself to come to Hawaii through somebody. But when she came here and her groom-to-be claimed her at the immigration station, she was shocked because she said in her own words, she was black, so dark, you know, working in the sugarcane field. So she couldn't stand. So she did follow him because she didn't know where to go. She couldn't speak English, right? So she didn't know where to go. She didn't even live with him for 3 months. She called a relative, you know, from a relative who was living here, who came from Hiroshima. So she lived with them for 3 months. And then the relative said, okay, your time is up. Either we have to send you back to Japan or you have to marry that man. So unwillingly, she got married to him. She had no choice. So see, there are a lot of true stories that it's kind of heartbreaking, but...
I want to get the process down. Mm-hmm. So can you talk about, like, if a man was looking for a bride, mm-hmm. how would things begin?
Okay. If he was here on the plantation and he feels ready to, he has the money to, you know, pay for the remittance, you know, for travel funds and all that, he would talk to a friend or first thing, write to his family back home that he's ready to settle down. So how about finding a woman for him? Yeah, that's the first, you know, procedure. And then the family themselves would look around the neighborhood looking for the right appropriate bride, you know, for their son or friend. And that's how it all gets started, yeah. And then if, even here, if they had a close friend, they would ask the close friend if they have somebody back home, a girl, appropriate age for that man, and who's willing to work, you know, on the plantation. And so, and then they give the background, and what happens is, they always, in those days, they had the investigation done by the go-between, the Nakodo or Baishakunin, or there's several names used, but the go-between is the Nakodo, and he usually tries to investigate, you know, the other side. So if he's looking for the bride for the friend's son, they would really do a thorough investigation, make sure the water's pure in the village, no leprosy, no insanity, and the temperament, you know, the character of the, you know, girl involved. They would make sure that, you know, she's properly trained. That's the way it was, yeah. So by the time they came here, it's amazing. Dr. Chen and I summed it up when we finished our interviews, and she did all the Korean brides. And there were more divorces among the Korean picture brides. But Japanese one, either they just, you know, took it for what, you know, they accepted their hardships and everything because they were embarrassed to go back as a divorced. The parents would never let them come back, you know, as a divorced woman. So,
So once the Nakodo was making the match, then what would happen?
Oh, they arranged the marriage. They had that ritual, you know, the Sansankudo. Well,
did they, like, send letters back and forth? Could you talk about that?
Oh, yes. The Nakodo would send the photos, like, in a toki case. And once they consent, of course, the girl has to sort of like the photo, right? So they would tell the parents, and, you know, many times, even if they were shy, somehow I think the parents knew, you know, or the go-between knew. So once that was done, they would send, you know, letters back and forth and consent. And then the man would send the remittance money. And, of course, the girl has to get ready, and they couldn't come immediately. They had to wait for the visa, the passport, 6 months period, a waiting period. They couldn't come immediately. And so during the 6 months period, some stayed with the in-laws, the future mother-in-law, and the mother-in-law could scrutinize the future daughter-in-law, and if the mother-in-law didn't like the daughter-in-law, she could send her back home. So it was a trying period for, you know, many times at that time already, the matchmaking would just, you know, be dissolved. Because if it didn't work well, if the mother-in-law didn't like the woman, she could write to the son that, you know, she didn't like it. But most often, I think it turned out well. Mrs. Tazawa told me hers was unusual. When she was sent to her future mother-in-law's home, she stayed for 6 months. She loved it better than staying at her own home, you know. And she said her mother-in-law was so good to her. When she parted with her, she cried because, you know, to come to Hawaii after the 6 month period, because she said, oh, that was the most wonderful time in her life. Better than after she got married to her husband. When she came to Hawaii, her husband was a womanizer. He gambled. And, you know, so she went through so much hardship when she came to Hawaii. And so she said that was the most wonderful time, which is a very unusual story for a picture bride liking her mother-in-law.
So can you describe again, did they have the wedding ceremony in Japan without the groom?
Or? Oh, yes. They had the temporary, you know, they call it Kalishugen, which is they marry by proxy. Either they have somebody standing in for the groom-to-be and the bride, you know, and then they sip the sake three times a total of 9 steps. Someone, you know, the Shinto ceremony, they have a girl dressed in pure white to serve the sake in the red, you know, the liquor cup. And so once that is exchanged, you're legally married. So even a proxy standing in for the husband, here the groom is in Hawaii. And once the name goes into the village register, you are declared, you know, already a bride of the family, even if the husband is in Hawaii.
And then did they have to get remarried in the United in Hawaii to have that recognized over
Yes,
here?
many times Miss Ogawa said, although she sipped the sake hurriedly, you know, in Hiroshima before her husband came to Hawaii, many women said, even if they went through the ritual with a proxy or Mrs. Toki, hers, instead of a proxy standing in, she had her bride to be, groom to be pictures on the higher shelf, you know, in her village, the shrine. And then with the photo, that woman from the Shinto, you know, temple had served the sake cup to her back and forth with the picture, with her husband's picture, they exchanged it. And that was already, that symbolizes the marriage ceremony. So with that, she had to wait 6 months to come. So it was very simple the way the marriage was done in Japan. And then when she came here, see, she had already done the ceremony by proxy in Japan. But when they came here, her husband did take her to the shrine in Honolulu, you know. And once again, they went through that ceremony with the drum, you know, Shinto priests, usually they hit the drum. And it's funny, one man told me, the more money you give, the more they hit the drum, and the louder the drum sounds, you know. They're happy with the big donation, but if you give little, they were so poor, some people gave only $2, $3 for the ceremony. And then they would just briefly do the ceremony and finish in no time, so.
So most of the, it sounds like most of the picture brides were joining field laborers. So like in that one example, you said that the woman didn't want to marry farmers and work in the rice paddies, but then she probably ended up marrying a
Oh,
sugar field worker. So
she
how did that marriage pan out?
That's the one. It was sad because she came as a picture bride in 1917. That's the one. She loved her mother-in-law. She stayed there 6 months after her name was entered in the register. Okay, she came here. And her husband was a very good-looking man, and he was on a sari. Few Japanese men had sari. $80 a month, that was considered very good sari. The average laborer, field worker, made only $20 a month, you know, 10 hours of work. Okay. But her husband died in 1928, the same year my father died. He died in January. But because he was good looking, the woman ran after him. He had, you know, he womanized, he drank, he gambled. When he died, she had only 35 cents in her coin purse. Imagine, with all the $80 a month, he hardly, you know, gave her money. And so she had to, you know, give him a proper funeral according to his status. He was in a very, you know, high social status in the village because he was a Luna, making $80 a month compared to $20 a month of the ordinary laborer. And so she didn't know how to conduct a decent funeral with only 35 cents. She couldn't even, she had two daughters and two sons, and the oldest daughter was only 9 years old. So she didn't even have enough to buy fabric to make the daughter's dresses with 35 cents. And so she had to beg the village woman to, you know, give her some material, and they donated a bleached rice bag, you know. And when you bleach it, it's nice white, you know, but rice bag is rice bag. And with that, a village seamstress took pity on her, and without charge, she made two dresses for the daughter. And the picture's in my book on the in the funeral section. And so the picture was taken, of course, a year later, so the daughters had shoes. By that time, they didn't have shoes, you know, for the funeral. And so they're wearing the rice bag dress. And so Mrs. Tazawa, Actually, as soon as the husband died, of course, the funeral, she didn't even have the $5 gratuity to give to the priest, and she didn't have the tea cakes that she's supposed to serve to the people who expressed their condolence. All those, the neighbors had pitched in, help her with it. And so she said she was so embarrassed that later on, when her life was a little better, and she could. But still, she couldn't hold her head high and walking down the street, because when she thought about the days, because the funeral was all done with all the neighbors pitching in, for everything. And immediately after her husband's passing, she started working in a sugarcane field. And she said from early in the morning to late in the night, 10 hours a day. And after she came back, of course, her oldest daughter, 9-year-old, couldn't go to school because she had to babysit the younger kids, and the camp police would come and pick her and, force her to go back to school. And next day she would stay home again because Ms. Tazawa said she didn't work in the field, they would starve. And so she kept that up, and so the daughter only went to 5th grade, off and on. And she would do sewing, working 10 hours in the cane field during the day. Late at night, under the dim light of the kerosene lamp, Eva Plantation didn't have electricity until I think 1938, 39. This happened in 1928. So they didn't have electricity until much later than Waipahu. And so under the dim light of the kerosene lamp, she did sewing. She made tabis for the workmen, bento bags and jackets. And first she didn't even have a sewing machine. So she said her fingers used to get pricked, used to get bleeding all the time. And it was so hard to penetrate the double layers of tabi that she sewed for people. She had to dip it into wax, the Chinese wax. She would dip the needle point into that to make it easier to penetrate the thickness of the denim, material. And so it was hard. And at that time, she thought she really felt like dying, she said. She thought of suicide many times. But when she looked at the four children sleeping so peacefully on the floor, on the futon, she said, how she could she just kill herself, and who would take care of the four children? And she said if she could walk across to Japan, she would have, no matter how many days, day, months it took her, she would have done that. But I think that's what thinking of her four children, and with no relatives around. She had a sister, but she had a family, but her parents were all in Japan. So she had no ways of survival, And so I think that kept her going, the mother instinct of thinking about her children's, interests first. She said that kept her going.